Thank you. Thank you, Vijay Dimate. It's been a real delight to prepare the talk, and I do feel very honoured that I'm here and sharing my personal reflections on conditionality with you today, with on my kind of very first Dharma day as a Dharma Prabha. And I've been very much kind of enjoying the preparations, and I just want to kind of also thank teachers and through books who kind of really were with me yesterday when I was reflecting. So Devan's book has really been a good guidance, and Devan as a teacher in Cambridge 1 year. And of course, Bhante Sangharakshita's survey was very much in use as well. I really, really appreciate him as a teacher, and he who illuminated the Dharma for us. So, what is the heart of the Dharma, the essence of the Dharma? And in a way, I suggest that to find out that, we recall into our minds the meeting between Sariputra, who later on became one of the leading disciples of the Buddha, and Asvajit, at the point when Sariputra had not yet heard of the Buddha and not yet heard of the Dharma. But he had already set his heart to find the path to a deathless, that was his quest, to find the doors of the deathless, the truth, or the meaning of the life, as we might like to phrase it, at the moment in our current lives. So the encounter between these two disciples at the time of the Buddha happens when Asvajit is on his alms round at Rajagaha, and Sariputra sees him and recognizes that Asvajit is someone who has attained the path of arahatse, attained the path of awakening. He's on that path. And after the alms round, Sariputra addresses Asvajit and says, "Friend, your aura is shining, your complexion is pure and bright. Under whom have you gone forth? Who is your teacher? Whose Dharma do you profess?" And again, this is a very typical question of those times. That's how seekers and spiritual practitioners were asking, well, who is actually your teacher? I'm very interested in that. Something in Asvajit was already telling he was on the path. And Asvajit replies that he has gone forth under the Blessed One, who is the son of Shakyas. So he's gone forth under the Buddha Shakyamuni. And Sariputra asks further, well, what about the teaching? What is the teaching the Buddha is giving? And Asvajit gives his answer in a very sort of humble way. He says, "Friend, I'm a beginner, recently gone forth, not long come to this Dharma and discipline. I am not able to teach you the Dharma fully, though I can tell you its meaning in brief." And then Sariputra presses even more, encourages, well, what is that teaching? And Asvajit says, "Those things conditionally arisen, the realized one has told their course. And ceasing of them too, this is the great renouncer's teaching." And once Sariputra actually heard this particular formulation of the Dharma, again the text says, "The spotless, stainless vision of the Dharma arose in Sariputra, that whatever is of a nature to arise will naturally cease." And then later on, Sariputra goes to the Buddha and becomes one of his disciples, goes forth under him. Later on, this particular formulation, this is one of the earliest ones found in the scriptures, and later on it became more shorter and more concise, and we might know it in the form, well, this being that becomes, in the arising of this that arises, this not being that does not become, in the ceasing of this that ceases. This is the oldest formulation of the Dharma, found embossed in clay seals, carved into miniature stupas or images of the Buddhas in ancient temples and sacred sites in India and across the Buddhist world. So this is really, I think, this sort of archaeological and historical way of finding these clay seals and carved and these stupas and images where this text is being carved sort of reminds us how precious, how dear, and how central this particular formulation, the heart of the Dharma, is. And if we want to express it in a more contemporary way, more accessible way, I'm following Devan's expression, we can say, "Everything that exists has come into being dependent on particular causes and conditions. And when those causes and conditions cease, the things that depend on them will also cease." And perhaps we can reflect the encounters of Asvajit and Sariputra a little further. Perhaps we can find them in us. If we have something of Sariputra's heart, we can notice that we are longing for something, longing for freedom, longing for meaning. Perhaps we are seeking the greater truth. It might not be kind of most obvious thing to say that we are searching for the doors to the deathless. That doesn't sort of really sort of be in our common parlance nowadays. But something in us is in our hearts, a similar longing that Sariputra had. And we are really, really fortunate if we meet Asvajit, who is able to inspire us, something in whom maybe their way of being, maybe their way of speaking, maybe their way of meeting us already inspires us and gives us a sense, well, there's something there, can I learn more about it? And then we might simply hear something of the Dharma that leads us further. We might have that sense through their practice and then found further and further teachings and the centers we go to. And for me, the heart of the Dharma began to unfold through my introduction to Buddhism course, where I learned about the Four Noble Truths, which is one of the most well-known application of this conditionality, of this formulation, to the human life and to our everyday life. The first noble truth acknowledges that there is suffering, that suffering is part of human experience, that the cause of suffering, as the second noble truth states, is craving, that we want things intensely, or we want things not to be as they are. Then the third truth says, well, suffering can cease, it can come to an end, and there is a way, as the fourth truth says, there's a way that leads to that coming to an end of suffering, and we can discover that. And at the time I came to the Dharma, I was searching for the right answer to the question why we suffer. For me personally, suffering or dukkha was my lifelong experience of living with a chronic illness that affects muscles and joints. In my life, I had been caught up with the why question before I heard the Dharma. Why do we suffer? Why did I fall ill when I was just a child? And these why questions came again and again. And they reflect very strongly our need to find explanation, find a single cause for a particular event or situation or experience we have. And that's what we are after. We are looking for that single cause. If I just knew that cause did, then my why question would be answered. But what is that enough? So during my teenage years, and I got very strongly engaged with the Christian faith, and I learned all kinds of explanations, all kinds of answers to the why question, why there is illness and suffering. And some of these answers were very punitive in my experience. None of them were liberating. And so when I listened to the explanation, square quotes, of Buddhism to the human suffering, that actually it is a part of human experience. It is a natural part of our lives. Our bodies fall ill and we suffer. We experience pain. It was much more liberating moment. I realized I'm not anymore in the odd circle of thinking of why this, why God punished me, why this happened, and all the rest of it, which never really gave me tools to live well with it, what I had, live well and fully aligned with my experience. So the Dharma gave me the answer, and I felt that at the beginning I really started to hear that heartbeat for the first time. Somewhere in me I knew that this was the path to follow. And from this initial vision, the journey began. So when the second noble truth states that the suffering is caused by craving, how can I apply that to my illness experience? Of course, illness has its physical and biological factors that cause physical symptoms and the experience of the pain in the body. But what we add, what I did add to that primary pain, was the suffering caused by craving, the intense wanting of things to be different. And that is something that was usually in my own life, that was the kind of sense that I want these things to go away. I don't want this experience. I don't want this pain. and then they don't go away, and I'm again caught up in that cycle. The Buddha talks about the second arrow, that the additional pain is caused actually by our reactive mind that doesn't want the experience we are having or does want in something that is not available. And so I started to reflect more and more, well, how can I change it? How can I actually start seeing more and more of the second noble truth in place, that I could actually start breaking that cycle, getting out of that futile effort of trying to make something go away when it doesn't. And the wheel of life, which is another description of the dependent origination or conditionality, provides a perspective how we can get free from that continuous way we hurt ourselves with the second arrow. In the wheel of life, we know that there are links of conditioned existence that describe how independence of contact, feeling arises, and how independence of feeling, craving arises. Again, this might sound a little bit abstract, but if we start thinking, again, in terms of my illness experience, we can see contact is the point where the illness is formed through the inflammatory processes in the body that then are signaled as pain, experience of pain through the nervous system. That is the contact. When I feel that, my mind starts reacting, as I said, and simply wanting to go away, and there is no further thought in that. So in a way, the response from the reactive mind keeps the wheel turning, keeps again and again the links repeating themselves, experience of pain, not wanting, and so it goes round and round. However, between the feeling of the pain, say that's my example, and craving of not wanting it, there is a little gap where we have a choice, where I have a choice. And instead of reacting to the pain, through practice, I can start applying mindful awareness. I can start bearing with my experiences just as it is. And I can start noticing that actually it has an ever-changing nature. These sensations come and they go. And I began to cultivate more and more what we know as the creative mind, the tendency of our mind to stay in that gap and to open out. And again, it is not a magic bullet. It doesn't happen once and for all, as we all know. It is a long practice. But through meditation and through reflection, we can start seeing that gap and we can start staying in that gap more and more and more often. And therefore, reconnecting with that openness and that liberation, that creative tendency. And this upward spiraling trend of conditionality that arises from that gap, from that choice we make, is a very important part of our understanding of conditionality as Sangharakshita has taught it. This spiraling trend can be traced back to the very early disciples of the Buddha, especially his female follower Dhammadinna, who is mentioned as a very foremost teacher. And this spiral path is the ever-unfolding chain of positive mental events or states that lead to liberation. Those states are usually listed as faith and joy, rapture, tranquility, bliss, concentration, knowledge and vision of reality, disenchantment, dispassion, and liberation. So there's a whole wealth of positive mental states arising if we manage to keep that moment of choice and that gap open. And the creative mind finds that gap in the wheel of life time and again and makes the choice not to follow the reactive cycle. So what is then this creative mind? Sangharakshita describes it as the creative mind is above all the aware mind. Being aware, the creative mind is also intensely and radiantly alive. One might say it is the spirit of life itself arising like a fountain of infinite depths of existence, vivifying through the creative person all with whom it comes into contact. really, really strong description of what creative mind has potential for. And the spiral path opens this to us. And through that, we can gain knowledge and vision of reality, which again deepens our trend to move towards liberation. And personally, I find this hugely inspiring and motivating. I keep thinking it is far too easy to see spiritual life as a continuous struggle, full of challenges, full of difficulties, fear of change. I'm not saying it is not that, but it is also a life lived for that creative mind to arise and manifest more and more strongly. And if we see that positive spiral, if we work towards that creativity, it becomes easier to bear those challenges and difficulties, and it becomes more natural to disidentify with the reactive mind, to disengage with the old habits, and resist the pull to go around the wheel again. So what is then the nature of reality? Not a small question at all, especially as we know that the humankind has spent endless ages with various attempts, especially intellectual attempts, through sciences and philosophy to find the answer. But the answer the Buddha's teaching of conditionality gives to us is described as marks of conditioned existence, or known as the three lakshanas. And what they say is that conditioned existence is actually insubstantial, impermanent, and unsatisfactory. And again, this is a clear challenge to us. We don't really like to hear that. We prefer things to be certain. We'd like things to be permanent, and we'd like them to be satisfying. So we get the idea that something we naturally, as human beings, are inclined towards is not the nature of reality. It is its opposite. And again, if we contrast this deeply held preference to the fact how reality really is, we get a clear idea why the wheel keeps turning. So instead of amplifying our resistance to how things are, we can also just listen to these characteristics of conditioned existence and hear them as the heartbeat of the Dharma. And this is the point where I like to reflect and bring the beauty into our minds. Again, rather than seeing something really difficult and something we resist, we can approach this by bringing beauty into our minds. And why is that important? The Buddha says in one of his discourses that beauty is the forerunner for the Eightfold Path, forerunner actually to the path that leads to liberation. He says, just as the dawn is the forerunner, the herald of the arising of the sun, so too friendship with the beautiful is the forerunner, the herald of the arising of the Noble Eightfold Path. And in a way, as we already discussed, this Eightfold Path is encapsulated in the Fourth Noble Truth. This is the path to liberation. And when we reflect the beautiful, and when we cultivate the friendship with the beautiful, again we start, we are in that creative space where we can reflect the reality, we can reflect the nature of reality. One example I can give is, I remember very vividly studying this material, studying conditionality on a retreat at Tirthan Loka. And I sat in the gardens that were bathing in sun in an August afternoon. Everything was blossoming and blooming. The greenness was very soothing. And I began to see very, very in small steps how everything arises and ceases upon conditions, including myself, because that is what the nature of reality is pointing to. We are part of reality and we are subject to these conditions. And I felt that that was really, again, the sound of the heartbeat of the Dharma. It was not anymore something I'd like to just react against or I'd find hard to grasp and understand. Just in sitting and seeing that and being in that experience, I felt a lot of appreciation and gratitude towards the mystery of life that was welling up in me. And so from that mystery of life, I have a sense that When we reflect the nature of reality and we study conditionality, we are not dealing with just cognitive understanding. It is not just something we memorize and recite and leave it like that. As the formulation that things arise in dependence on conditions and cease when those conditions cease, sounds very fairly simple, we might think. This was what Ananda, one of the Buddha's disciples, thought and made this remark. And the Buddha warns us against that simplicity and says, dependent arising is deep and profound. And he continues by saying that it is actually by not understanding and by not penetrating this Dharma that we are in this tangle of string, as he used the image, tangle of string covered in mold and matted like grass. It is not by not understanding this, we carry on with our reactive minds and we keep repeating our habitual way of being. We are unable to escape samsara, its miseries and disasters, or bad destinations. And only when we really realize, only when we really penetrate the Dharma, that's where the liberation arises. And I would like to bring a sense of the liberation in a form of a poem from an early Buddhist nun, Sister Uttama, who expresses that realization and brings together these formulations and reflections I've talked about so far. So Sister Uttama says, the Buddha taught seven factors of enlightenment. They are ways to find peace, and I have developed them all. I have found what is vast and empty, the unborn. It is what I've longed for. I am a true daughter of the Buddha, always finding joy in peace. I have ended the hunger of gods and humans, and I will not wander from birth to birth. I have no thought of becoming. So from her expression of the experience of liberation, we really get to feel how deep and profound the Dharma is, how it is that eternal law, the law that the Buddha revered at the point of his awakening, his enlightenment. And as a law, it is always there, always waiting for us to realize it. And Sangharakshita writes that the quality of enlightenment is inherent in the universe, or more correctly, latent in every form of consciousness, and therefore must come to maturity according to universal law whenever conditions are favorable. And I find this deeply, deeply inspiring, that the quality of enlightenment is latent in every form of consciousness. That the greatest fruit, the true and full liberation, release of heart, awakening, is based on this conditionality, based on this eternal law of the Dharma. And there's no arbitrariness to it. Nobody's throwing a cosmic dice, whether we can realize it or not, whether it's possible for you and me. It's not dependent on age or gender or race or any of those kind of usual things through which we make distinctions. It is always possible, and every time, that's how I feel, every time we open up to this law, every time, however minute steps we take to accept the reality, to align ourselves with it a bit more, every time we stand in the gap, every time we recognize the choice, we move more and more closely to that. We, as it were, are listening to the heartbeat of the Dharma more clearly. And in a way, this brings us back to the Buddha. Because, in a way, we can say the heart of the Dharma is the heart of the Buddha. And the story of one of Buddha's disciples, Vakkali's encounter with the Buddha, tells us that. Vakkali is a monk who was seriously ill and asked the Buddha to visit him because he couldn't go and see the Buddha. He couldn't join the Buddha's Sangha. He was he was housebound. So the Buddha goes to Vakali, and Buddha says, "Enough of your wanting to see my putrid body. Vakali, who sees the Dharma sees me, and who sees me sees the Dharma."